Welcome to the Breakpoint Show. I am Gil Gross alongside Alex Druskin, as always. On this show, we break down the Netflix docuseries Breakpoint episode by episode. And here we are. It's been a long road, Grusky. Episode 10, season one. It is the end of the 2022 episodes of Breakpoint, which is, of course, the inaugural season. So it's over. We want to do something special for this one. And that's why it's taken a little while for us to do this. So we just brought on the showrunner. That's all. Carrie Leah Sim was kind enough to join us on this show. We're going to talk about episode 10 for a little while. And then we will, we're going to go to the interview and then we're going to talk about episode 10, right? That's what we talked about in the production meeting, Gruskin. Let's have you sell this interview. All right. Have you any sales experience?
You know, I do not have sales experience. Thankfully, I had a real job right out of college. Sorry, I'm kidding. No, look, it was an absolute delight to do this interview. And it's an inside baseball little joke here to start the show. But to the Netflix crew watching this episode, thank you for all you did to make this possible. I got a little teary-eyed at the end of this interview. Got a little teary-eyed watching the end of this episode because it has been a fun journey with you, my friend. It's been a really fun first season. And yeah, I think more than anything coming out of this interview, you'll understand the process of the choices that were made behind each episode. The idea of not only finding players that would captivate and capture the attention of viewers everywhere, but captivate was not the word there. Capture was. It's also about cultivating those storylines and following where the tennis took them, and hearing about that process was fascinating. I think all of us want to know how were the decisions made. You get great insight into that in this interview. So I promise, again, it is the coup de grace. It is the feather in the cap. It is the perfect way for us, in my opinion, to end this series.
Showrunner Carrie Leah to find out how the sausage gets made here. It's a pleasure to be joined on the Breakpoint Show by the showrunner for season one of the docuseries, Carrie Leah. Carrie, we're so glad you're with us and can't wait to ask you about the creation of this show and the show itself. But I kind of want to start with just a you question. You got to experience this traveling circus that was the tennis tour. And, you know, previously, whatever your relationship with tennis was, it certainly wasn't that. So what was it like and what surprised you?
It was completely amazing. And I think anyone, you know, we try to give a little sense of what it's like to move every week. But I think until you've experienced it, you have no idea how crazy it is and how intense it is. I have so much respect for the people that do it week in and week out, because it's different than any other sport in that way. You are constantly on the move. You are, you know, might have your own team, but you're on your own. And for us as a production, we had to think quite carefully about, you know, you can get wrapped up in the kind of weekly drama that's going on with these players, because it's always happening. It never, you know, they never turn off or very rarely turn off. And so for us, like in terms of, you know, the very first tournament I went to was Indian Wells, and you get completely swept up in that. And then you have to go, wait a second, how do we make this make sense to people who know nothing about tennis? And so that's what we were trying to do.
How has your relationship to tennis changed? Like now that you're watching from afar, just give me like the before after Carrie as a tennis fan.
I mean, okay, before I was like exactly what you would expect. I'd watch like the Wimbledon final. I think that I knew a bit about Rafa. If you would have laughed at any of my knowledge, though, it was terrible. I'd watch the US Open bits. And that was it. I went to a couple tennis tournaments, you know, I went to a Wimbledon, like, you know, like, but that was it. Now I'm obsessed. Literally, when I was waiting for you guys, I was checking the scores of Toronto, because I'm like addicted and I love it. It's such, now that I know more about it, I love it. So interesting.
No, that it's fascinating to hear. And I do want to explore more of your story, but I'm curious, as you sit down to sort of plot out what season one's going to look like, are you in that outline? Tailoring things towards yourself is not what I mean by that question, but are you tailoring things towards your style of fandom? Someone who maybe superficially might know a little bit about the sport, but hadn't dive in? Or, you know, again, are you looking to appeal to the Gills and I of the world, where it's like, you know, if you're not talking Emil Ruusuvuori, you don't even have our attention. I'm curious how you balance those two things.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it was always going to be a Netflix series. And I think what you know, for a Netflix series to go out and for it to do well, it has to appeal not just to an American audience or a European audience, but it has to, we want it to have a massive appeal because we want people to fall in love with tennis. And we want people to fall in love with tennis that know nothing about tennis. And then we hope, and I think you see this as the series progresses, but you will see things that you would never normally see in normal, you know, tennis broadcasting, as, you know, the access got better and we had more time and all of that stuff happened as the tournaments went on. But, you know, I think ultimately you want it to be the kind of series that everyone falls in love with. And so I think there was a little bit of, you know, having to introduce people that know nothing about tennis. Formula One's different. You just go, you know, anyone that knows about Formula One would hate me saying this, but ultimately you go around in circles, right? Tennis is a different game. It has a different sport. So there's a certain amount of introducing the sport to people who don't know anything about it that might be frustrating if you know a bit more about it. But once you get past that, then you can have some fun.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And, you know, again, to see how you guys explored those little details, even basic things like love 15 as opposed to 1-0, and being like, look, it was a math thing, they're weird, like, you guys just let's move past it, this is the vernacular they use. I mean, I imagine there was an acclimating process for everyone who worked on this show, right, in speaking in the tennis vernacular. Because I'm curious, in your experience, if you have noticed, as you kind of alluded to, it's a different world, isn't it, than sort of the other sporting things you see?
Yeah, well, our one of our series editors named Itamar Klasmar, who's absolutely fantastic, he grew up playing tennis. And you know, I in my mind, he was like semi-professional, but I'm not sure that's my dream for Itamar, but I'm not sure that was exactly because, but he did very well and got kind of knee deep into tennis, as lots of people do as a teenager. And so he was like our kind of tennis guru, where, you know, if we, you know, ever had to get into the nitty gritty and we needed, if anyone on the team really needed to ask those kind of questions, we could get into it. But ultimately, I think we said, you know, that when we looked at scoring, we went for the easier option, because we're trying to tell a story as opposed to, you know, get really confused on scoring. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe there was other way to do it. You never know. You do your best and then you see how it works, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. What was, because you do this for a living, this won't be your first show. This wasn't your first show. It won't be your last. What drove you crazy about this project? Like, what was really hard to kind of pull off here?
I have to keep it clean. No, I'm joking. There were lots of difficulties. There were a lot of wonderful things about it. I mean, honestly, I absolutely loved making it. So, you know, there were loads of wonderful teams, loads of wonderful things, a lot of that being the team. The difficulty was time. The executive producers got incredible access and they had to go very, very quickly. So the first two episodes were shot with a great Drive to Survive team, but not with the actual team. And so we came to it a little bit late and we're chasing our tails a little bit. And then we had to deliver very, very quickly after that. So you probably, the first five episodes, we worked so hard and tried to make the best possible, but we had to do that extremely quickly. I wish we had more time, you know, that was the thing, you know, around October. I wasn't really a person. I don't think any of us were people. We were just literally working every single hour, trying to do the best we could. And then in the second half, we had a little bit more time. And I think that probably shows.
I like the idea of you just being like, what do I like least? And you answering that, I fucking hate Matteo Berrettini. You're like, I'm just done with him. That was not her answer.
You can't hate Matteo, though. He's so nice.
Yeah. It would have been a zag.
I know. I should give you like more kind of juicy. I know. Right?
No.
I
think that's interesting to know, right? I mean, that something like that, like, oh, mm-hmm. We had a really tight timeline for the first five and a lot more time for the second five. What did you like better about the second batch? And it's always interesting. I don't know if we should get into this, but just all of these streaming companies have to make decisions now about how they are going to release. Is it going to be all at once, and then it's kind of a binge experience? Is it going to be weekly, like Succession on HBO or a lot of the HBO shows? So yeah, it's a crazy world now in streaming. But I definitely want to know why you're more proud of, or you think that the product was better, or where we could see that you had more time based on what the second five looked like compared to the first five.
Yeah, I should rephrase that. It wasn't necessarily, we didn't, technically we probably didn't have more time in the second half. It was just that we, you know, you find your feet and you kind of feel things out and you get to see a sense of how they're working. And we had more time to prepare those as well, I would say. And also you get to know the players better. Like when we first came in, I don't know if you guys were in Indian Wells or at the French, at Roland Garros, but you know, by that point they were getting to know us, but it took time. Like people are not, it's a different sport. There are certain sports that are used to letting people have the cameras come in. And I didn't, you know, tennis is a little, people are more closed off. You know, you don't get the most gregarious social people in the world necessarily wanting to be professional tennis players because it's a very isolating sport. So, you know, it takes time to get people to open up and talk to you. I mean, you know, some of them are more outgoing than others, but you know, it takes time to get your, you know, so by an episode 6 or 7, you know, we've gotten to know people for 6 months by that point. So it's, you know, it's just different. And I suppose, sorry, I should slightly rephrase that. It's not just time, but it was that's what I mean by time that made it slightly easier as well.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a fascinating thread because those who follow the tennis tour closely and those who know people in the tennis universe know, especially for players, there's a lot of downtime at events. If you're not on a practice court, if you're not playing a match, a lot of the times you're sitting in a bed or you're getting a massage, whatever it may be. And I'm curious, you talk about that process of getting to know the players. You know, what came first, finding the players to follow or picking the storylines to monitor? If that makes sense, because you're in Australia, right? And to have Nick win the Australian Open doubles title, I mean, that is a gift to a showrunner, I imagine. But you know, what comes first, pursuit of the players or pursuit of the storyline?
Yeah, so yeah, good question. By the time I came on, they had already done the Australian Open. So, I think that was a discussion. There was always a sort of discussion between us and you know, we asked the ATP and the W2A, who do you think is really interesting? You know, who would you say? We asked around, just asked advice from people. What do you think? And, you know, obviously you can look at rankings, but rankings are very precarious, as you know, like that's not necessarily the best way to pick up, you know, what's going to happen. No one knows, especially in the WTA, no, in the women's tennis, no one knew last year what's going to happen, right? It was a very, you know, if you had told people that Ons Jabeur was going to have a breakout year, people might not have necessarily thought that. So what we did is that we had a kind of group of players, and maybe between men and women, there was probably about 30 that we kind of thought they're quite interesting, and we got to know them all. And then we just saw what happened, you know? So like for episode 3 in Indian Wells, we were probably following a dozen people. No one thought Taylor Fritz was going to win Indian Wells, you know, but we were filming with them because we thought, he's a Californian kid and this is a Californian tournament. And actually, the executive producer had his spidey sense told him this was Taylor's year, you know, so we were like, okay, let's go. But like, you don't know, it's just a hunch. And so we got to be good friends with quite a few people, and then we just saw what happened.
Mm-hmm. No, I feel like, again, right now, present event, I don't know how well this is aged, the Mega Millions or the lottery here in the United States is $2.1 billion. It's going to be a record. I feel like I would still rather hit the lottery by having Ayla Tomjanovic beat Serena and then invest in her early in the episode, because like that is the ultimate gift to keep on giving. But no, I mean, again, I joked around. As you're following those people, are there moments where, you know, Ken, I joked with Taylor when we had him on the show after he hurt his ankle. I'm like, did they say, hey, cut, like, we need you to fall a little more dramatically? Like, just can we get a little better shot for you, please? And obviously that's not the case. But as you're following a storyline like that, do you say to the player, hey, this is now probably the thing, so let's try to expand on it? Or is that all post-editing?
Never. I mean, no. I remember listening to that episode and I was just kind of shouting like, oh my gosh, you actually, do you
No.
think that we would like, or they would even listen to us if we did that? No, we are there to follow what happens and we don't say anything. No, that we are like, when they say fly on the wall, we're, you know, our teams, we have such fantastic producers and directors led by Martin Webb, who had done also all of the Drive to Survives. And so, you know, it is very much like you stand back and you film. And there might be moments when you're in a car, or maybe if something happened where you might ask them about it when it felt appropriate. But if something's unfolding, you just film and you stay filming, and that's what you do. Yeah.
How much did Drive to Survive inform this? Obviously, big hit. It was kind of like, let's do one on golf, let's do one on tennis. But we even talked about at the top how the sports are different. Obviously, you have some of the overlap in terms of the team as well. But how much can you actually look to Drive to Survive and be like, this is what we're trying to do and this is the model versus let's create something completely different?
Yeah, I mean, well, we were really lucky because we had Martin, series director, and Nanook Walter, co-executive producer, was the series producer on Drive to Survive, and then we had the same, you know, the same executive producers. So there was some follow through with that, but I think from the very beginning we decided we wanted it to be totally different than that. Obviously, you know, Drive to Survive is fantastic with that adrenaline and that feeling of being in there and that kind of, but it, tennis is so different. There is no way. We never felt like we could make it like Drive to Survive. It's very different. The way people interact with each other is different. The sport is different. And actually, we felt like there was something much more intimate in that kind of gladiatorial feel when you have two people that are actually looking each other in the eye and facing each other. And it was such a mental game, you know, and that was what we really wanted to get across is like, actually, the best 50 players in the world on any given day, you don't necessarily know who's going to beat who. But actually, a lot of that comes down to the mental resilience, and the best players in the world have that. And that was the message that we really wanted to get across. But you know, you can also learn that as well, and or you can grow into that. So yeah.
Yeah, very different personalities. I wonder if you sometimes wish that tennis players had, for lack of a better phrasing, just more balls to speak their mind because they are very careful, right? They don't want to upset people. You have two drivers on the same F1 team and they're going at each other wearing the same uniform.
Yeah.
Tennis, it's supposed to be an individual sport. Everybody's playing against each other and half the time they don't want to insult anybody.
I know you're also polite. You're also polite.
Yeah.
I know, I remember reading the, you know, what you always read, like what people think about the show, and they were saying, oh, they're not arguing, they're not fighting with each other. And we're like, mate, if people had were fighting, we would have felt like we would have showed it. Trust me. Like it just does it. Well, maybe it happens. And actually, there was moments like in episode six, what at Wimbledon with Nick Kyrgios and Steph playing each other. You know, obviously there was tension. There was genuine tension there. So we show that. But you know, for the most part, people are pretty polite, or there might be a word or something that they say later. But it's just a different sport, you know.
That's a thread I want to follow up on because, to your point, another moment that sticks out to me is early on when you're introducing us to Taylor as before Indian Wells, and you ask him who's the best American man right now. He's like, "Well, I know you're trying to get me to say statistically I'm the highest ranked, but like I don't really want to say that if that's okay." And it's like, dude, you can answer the question as me. We imagine all of you feel that way. I did notice from episode to episode the ones that really seemed to resonate with fans were the ones that featured conflict. So for me, the number one conflict of the opening season was Isla versus the US Open crowd. If you couldn't have that feeling resonate with you, I just don't know what to tell you as a fan of life in general. I'm curious if that, for lack of a better term, dearth of conflict, how was it frustrating? Did it make, episode to episode more difficult for you guys, or did you feel like you could still find those sorts of storylines?
Oh yeah, no, not at all. Because we didn't expect to find, you know, we knew that it was a different sport, so we weren't worried about that. You know, I think what we tried to show and what we were really fascinated by was the inner conflict, you know,
Yes.
And I think that's where we were going with it, is like the conflict is yourself. I think Maria Zachary's mom said it best, like quite often you're not playing the player in front of you, you're playing yourself. And I think that's what we were trying to show. And I think also what you're picking up on a little bit perhaps is the fact that like with the players, the ones who gave us the most and were like totally open with us were the ones that did, you know, featured probably more and the audience loved, because, you know, Taylor and especially his girlfriend Morgan, they're such nice people, you know, they were open, like they did not change when we turned the cameras on, they were exactly the same, and they were just really open, like, hey, do you guys want to come along? And we come along, and we didn't, wouldn't say anything, they would just carry on as normal, which for us is, we want to show things as they really are. So that's really useful. Isla and her dad, oh my God, they're like, they're just so, they're such wonderful people, they're so kind, and they are so open. I mean, I remember the first time we filmed him, it was at Roland Garros, and we were just, Isla went out early, and we were just following her into the cafeteria, and we hadn't really met her mom and her dad yet, like not, and she just walked up to them, and you know, there's a camera there, and they just completely carry on as absolutely normal, like they don't even bat an eyelid. Whereas like for you and me, if someone turned up and put a camera in your face, you know it's Netflix, you might feel a bit weird, which is totally natural. So I think definitely some of the players who let us in, it comes across and it resonates because they are open, and it makes a difference.
Well, let the record show, if Netflix wants to send cameras to Gil and I, we will happily open our doors and say anything they need to say. So I think I'll speak for Gil on that one. But no, I totally understand that. And you're right. Like there are little tidbits, little conversations, like with Isla and her dad, the dad being like, oh, I probably got to book a couple extra days at the hotel. I've had that conversation with my dad. Like every tennis player has had that conversation at a tournament. At the same time, on the other half of the glass, and I don't want to get you in trouble, but were there players who were like, hey, can we not do that? Or can we not say that or not explore that topic? Because as Gil alluded to earlier, we can be sensitive as a people, as a tennis playing populace. We, you know, it's individual. So if I'm criticizing someone, it's a direct criticism. There's no hiding under the veneer of saying, well, you know, that team could be better at passing the football. Like you can't do that. It has to be a pretty direct criticism.
Yeah. I would say maybe the people that were a bit like where you described, maybe just would not invite the cameras in as much. So they would, like, people wouldn't say to us, oh, can you put the camera down? Like when we were filming, if we were filming, we were filming, and they're really open. If they invite us in, like that was kind of the deal. And a lot of my job was talking to the agents and talking with the players and kind of saying, look, like if we're there, we're there kind of win or lose. And that's the whole point. And a lot of the players really wanted us to show what it was like when you lost, you know, mm-hmm. It was really important. Like with Paula Badosa, for example, she really wanted us to, you know about those conversations that go on about, you know, the fragility of playing day to day. And so they wanted, so maybe the instances that we had were actually people just not letting the cameras in more, but if they let them in, then they were pretty open. Yeah.
The only specific player I want to ask about is Nick, because he is definitely.
Of course you do.
Exactly. He is. He definitely qualifies as one of those players who gave you a lot, who opened up some of the most, in my opinion, the most tender and vulnerable moment in the entire season was Nick, talking about his Wimbledon experience from a couple years back, but also. Some tennis fans don't like Nick, and you know, yeah. it's a polarizing figure in the sport. Was there discussion of, okay, how much should he be the face of this? Because there are downsides to that and upsides to that.
Yeah. You know, Netflix was pretty, you know, we make the films, you know, and then there's another bit, you know, slightly above my pay grade, you know, people that kind of have these discussions about which film becomes episode one or, you know, that kind of thing. And how that's placed. So I would say, you know, our job was to make Nick, like everyone has an opinion about Nick, right? Like everyone. And even on our team, like not, you know, and I would say the people who filmed with him and met him personally, like, you know, really had a camaraderie with him. But, you know, there were, you know, people in the editing team that, you know, stayed in the edit that might have felt that it was tricky. And what I would always say to the team is like, look, we need to show him as we saw him, like show him the way that he came across to us and the team, and let the audience make up their own mind. Like, I found it interesting that people felt so positive about him from episode 6, because we were just really trying to show him the way he was and the way that he came across. Like, we weren't hiding anything. And so, you know, some people might love him from watching that, and some people might hate him, but that wasn't our job to make you love or hate him. That was really important to us.
He's a complicated dude. And yeah. I think that's the most important kind of thing to unpack the layers of him. So I certainly enjoyed his inclusion, and I'm glad that he was in there, and I think it served the show well. Let me knock down the what is it, the third wall? Did I hit Gruskin?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's very tender to knock down that fourth wall, Gil, which fourth, by the way was a great wall. Word choice. Yeah, I think.
Well, I said third, so yeah. I lowballed.
You're not at the fourth wall. I'll break down the fourth for us. Don't
okay,
worry.
we're gonna do the fourth wall thing. Yeah. You actually DM'd Cracked Rackets, and that's how this relationship started, and that's why we're talking right now, which is amazing. We were so happy about that. But it also means that you listen to our show. We listen to you listen to us kind of break down episode by episode. Yeah. I got to now give you the floor. I mean, responses to anything that you remember or sticks out to you, or kind of what you kind of took away from listening to our breakdowns.
Yeah, our whole team, I think, listen to your shows, especially in those January dark days where we were still carrying on with the second half of the series and you guys were looking at the first five, and we really enjoyed them, and we thought we loved your enthusiasm for the series. And you know, there were so many things that you thought about or questioned, which were things that we also thought about and questioned, you know, and so we thought that was great. I think the only thing that, I didn't listen to the whole episode, but I think you brought someone on who might have made like one documentary before, and his kind of documentary, he made another drama. Oh yeah, Billions. And drama and documentary is totally different. And even if you've made a documentary before, trying to make this kind of documentary is totally different. And I think he was sort of saying, oh, why didn't you have more conflict? And you just think, mate, if we knew where, like, if there, you don't know who's going to win, you don't know who's going to lose, you have no idea. There's 128 players times two, so you know, you're trying to figure that out. And I think that felt like a little, I don't want to sit on the negatives, because that was a little bit like that, you know, you were kind of yelling and thinking, oh dear, you know, that it's so different. Yeah. Making a drama than it is making this kind of documentary that's extremely fast paced, extremely fast turnaround. It's just a total, it's like comparing tennis with football. I mean, it's just totally different, right? So, but other than that, we loved your shows and thought they were fascinating and thought about some of the insights. And you know, it's great. It's like we spend every single day of our lives trying to make this series great, and for you guys to watch the shows and engage with them for us was really fascinating.
No, appreciate you saying that. I would have also taken two very handsome men, like great eyebrows. That was probably also the reaction at some point. But I am curious, because again, to break down the fourth wall or whatever wall Gil is focused on in the moment, one thing we talked about in our episodes that I wanted to ask you about is the difficulty in allocating time to show tennis itself. And what I mean by that is that's something we talked about a lot. A good point in tennis takes 45 seconds. You guys only have 45 minutes for an episode or whatever it may be. You have to be economical in your choices. How difficult was that balance? How difficult is it to broadcast tennis, you know, to feature the tennis itself in each episode?
Yeah, that was a real challenge. And actually we would do the first cut of a game and it would be like 10 to 15 minutes, you know, and that was massively cut down. And then we had to decide what the key moments were. And then it was really about the story. So yeah, tennis it's very long, and we had these, you know, we had to crunch, you know, you only have, some of the films were actually 40 minutes. So when we had to take out, you know, we had to kind of crunch that down. Tennis was like, you know, tennis probably took a bit of the hit, but I think that was because for us, we were trying to tell a story, and we felt like if you want to go back and you want to watch the game, like everybody knows where they are, like you can go back and watch them, but actually the key is the key story points, you know, and those key, what's really going on mentally for that player. But, you know, I understand that. I mean, we would have loved to have showed the games for much longer.
No, I think we understood that on our end as well. Is look, more than anything, so for instance, I think we talked about this on one of our shows, Gil and I, you would watch the highlights from a match and you'd be like, wait, I want to go to YouTube and see if there's extended tennis highlights, because now I'm intrigued by the storyline. Now I want to remember, see if I know this match as it's depicted. And, you know, again, I think showing those storylines has to have been the ultimate decision for you. And this is a little moment, you know, again, this is a throwaway question, but I'm just curious, because talk about a transcendent moment for the sport. Were you in Tunisia for the reception of Ons Jabeur following making a slam final? Because to see that stadium, to see that theater packed, just that's a moment for tennis. And I think, you know, again, why this show is so encouraging for people like Gil and I, who have made this sport our lives, is it does provide a platform for players that may not otherwise have it to catapult them to that next level of stardom. I'm curious if you felt that at all in the Ons experience, if you were there at that theater for the reception, because it was a standout moment.
Yeah, that moment was totally incredible. So our shooting director, Aoife Carey, and our producer, Killian, were there, and our sound man, and they, you know, they'd been shooting Wimbledon, you know, for the, so everyone's pretty exhausted, especially Ons and our team. And it was pretty, it was really, really intense, and everyone was, you know, exhausted. And, but to see that reception and to see that experience, I think, you know, is something that they keep talking about and how incredible it was. And I'm so happy that we were there to capture that, because we didn't know that that was necessarily going to happen. I mean, we had, you know, Ons didn't know that was going to happen. And so, you know, she knew that there was a lot of interest and excitement about her playing, but that was pretty phenomenal. And I think we were so happy to be able to show that what a positive impact she is making on her own country. So this is great.
Love that. I'm glad the flight to Tunisia after Wimbledon paid off. It certainly did. I know this is an area where you're limited in what you can say, but I still have to ask, like, what's next for the show? Is there, what can you say about the next season and kind of how it's going to be created and all that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not working on the series two, so that's really tricky for me to say. I know the team is working incredibly hard and, you know, doing their absolute best to make it fantastic. But, you know, that's we didn't end up finishing until April, and they had to start way back in kind of December. So it just is a massive overlap. So but, you know, I know the team is working incredibly hard, and yeah. And not getting to watch as much tennis for pleasure as they might like. Filming it all the time.
Yeah, you have it. You have it the best. But we definitely hope that you kind of rejoin. And that's interesting to hear about a timeline like that. Is there anything you're working on now that you want to plug that we should keep our eye on?
Yeah, there's lots of really exciting things, but probably nothing I can talk about just yet. But
oh no.
Okay. But yeah, no, I mean, I, you know, our the team that made it are fantastic. And, you know, we just I had to drop you a little message to say, you know, to let you know that we were listening, because we were having a little giggle. We're like, do you think when they're recording these, they realize like our whole team is listening? And we were, and we loved it. So thank you.
Well, appreciate you saying that. Let me ask one more, because there's a lot of footage. Again, massage rooms, meals, and all these funky practices. Was there a list of bloopers where you're like, hey, players, we would like to show all these moments, but we like, is this cool with you? Like, for instance, you know, sometimes you play butts up where you're doing a hitting competition, someone smacking serves at a coach or whatever it may be, and just like
that in.
Yeah, that's true. That was included.
Yeah.
No, I'm not put that in. I mean, like, no. I think if there were bloopers, yeah, we would have, you know, we weren't afraid to show anything like that. So, but even like something like Taylor saying, who's the best player in the world? You know, we asked Iga, we kept, you know, kept it in the questions in, you know, we didn't mind showing the questions not going the, you know, we thought it actually showed their personality. Like Iga, when we ask her, what tournaments have you won this year? And she goes, like, she doesn't want to actually have to. Yeah. It's very Iga because she doesn't want to show off. She's not a show off. She's like a really, you know, incredibly hardworking, wonderful girl. And, you know, that we thought that her sighing said more about her personality than, you know, because otherwise you might just think, oh, we don't need to put that in. But actually her being a bit bored by the question was funny, you know?
she gave a dissertation. She's like, here's my thesis for why I'm world number one. It's because I won this tournament, then this tournament, then this tournament. So in conclusion, I'm the best. And you're just like, yeah, that's an Iga answer for you. No, it was very well done.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
Well, Carrie, we appreciate you staying up late for us in London, and we'll stay in touch. This has been a pleasure.
Definitely. Thanks so much, guys. You take care.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
All right, back, just the two of us, how it started and how it will end as we wrap up season one of Breakpoint. But that was great with Carrie. That was kind of our addition to be on the show. Do you think we'll make it?
I hope so. I think we looked the part. I wish I didn't look so animated, but that's the life, the road life for you. Every so often, hotel internet isn't going to cooperate. I like that. We're ending with just the two of us. I mean, your YouTube following's pretty big, so I don't want to get you in copyright trouble and nail my perfect impression of that song. But yeah, that was a blast, just because to have the showrunner. I mean, is that what we dreamed about when we talked about doing this series? And so can't thank her enough for taking the time to join the show. And, you know, again, hopefully we'll continue to have opportunities like that in the future for all of you viewers, so you can get a look behind the glass, see how all the decisions are made.
Yeah, it turns out making TV is a lot different than watching TV.
Yeah, that's so true. You realize it. I'm coming out again on the road life. I'm in the Tennis Channel studio. And yeah, you see how the sausage is made. And you're just like, oh, yeah. The quote for me, and then we can get into episode 10, but and perhaps this is a good transition, is just the thing we have talked about, a prevailing theme in all 10 episodes, is how do you properly portray the actual tennis as it unfolds? And does the tennis itself have to be a central character, central theme in a show like this? And, you know, again, what I really loved about our conversation is how clear the answer to that question is no, how it has to be personality driven, how you have to, you know, again, conflict will only emerge if a character within the show allows it. And yeah, I just feel like I have a better grasp of, oh, that's why you made that choice. It makes sense.
Yeah. All right. Let's start on character driven, because this was Aryna Sabalenka heavy. We are at the year end championships. I was looking forward to this part of the year, actually, or the portrayal of these events, because they're unique, obviously, when it comes to only the top eight are there. And they do a lot of interesting kind of media and press events and photo shoots beforehand. They get all glammed up, which is how the episode started. But I kind of want to start with Aryna herself, because I thought she was one of the best characters in season one. Like, she has a brutal honesty about her and a compelling story that included a lot of adversity that I think was the main hook of this episode.
It's fascinating because the episode's called One Last Chance, and that obviously ties into the Aryna Sabalenka story. She did not start her 2022, not to get too tennis-y, but she did not start it in the proper way. There was a moment where the gap between her, in terms of how many double faults she hit, and the second place person on the WTA Tour was as big as the gap between the second place person and the 38th place person. That's no bueno. That's going to fuck with your head. Sorry, first curse slipped out. That's going to happen here today. I'm a little fatigued. I think One Last Chance is actually, and I mean this in the most positive sense, a good episode title for the show in general. It's the season finale. You need to hook people back in and say, why will I watch this show moving forward in the future? And to go full circle here, I think Sabalenka is a character for exactly why you do that, because you just see the entire roller coaster of a season as low as it can get, why you have to continue to persist. If you do persist, the rewards that sit at the end of the finish line, all of that was encaptured within the first 10 minutes of meeting Sabalenka. And the thing I really enjoy is it felt she was particularly, I mean, every character was, but she was particularly open in talking through her struggles, not just on the court, but how her mental, the impact of maybe some struggles she was having off the court immediately leaked into her tennis as well. It just encapsulated a little bit of everything we saw this series within one storyline.
Yeah. She was more open, I think, than most. I don't think we need to mince words there. She was, you know, there was, first of all, a scene where she, you know, we talked with Carrie about the cameras and how, you know, the players, most of them were able to carry about their business and not change their behavior. Remember when Sabalenka started like weeping and she looked at the camera and she's like, now everybody is going to see me fucking losing it. And like, you know, it was kind of a moment where she was making fun of being on camera, but also it showed just how hard this year has been for her. And yeah, she talks about the war in a way that I just thought she was a little bit more comfortable discussing the topic in this Netflix setting versus maybe with the press. And I mean, I thought we got some really good vulnerability. She said that she just has really felt bad as a Belarusian, that her coach said that there's a lot of pressure or a lot of, I guess, feeling that you can't talk about it and you can't say anything, which is something that's definitely been discussed. So that was great.
Not to get too political, and we're going to get back to that quote because that's the best quote of the episode, and we'll talk about it in a second. But it is important to note that even this season, 2023, as Sabalenka has emerged as a Grand Slam champion and a prospect for world number one, if not the best player of the season, certainly top two, she had stopped taking press conferences at Wimbledon, at other events, because she had continued to be asked about this conflict. And, you know, at a certain point, it's worth remembering the Belarusian government is not a government that thrives in freedom, that thrives in freedom of expression in particular. And so she is straddling a line. It's a stark reminder of what that line actually looks like. You hear about it and you think you understand it, but then you see not only her address it, you mentioned the key point there. To see someone so close in her inner circle, in her coach, have to address, no, you guys don't understand what Arena's been going through. Let me elaborate more. It's the piece of context that the next time this happens, you tweet the clip from Netflix and you say, God, like, this is the context to remember. And of course, you always hope for the most for these athletes. You'd love a world where they can all step out and speak freely, speak openly. It's a stark reminder that sadly, that is not the case around the world. And through all of that is what Sabalenka is competing in.
Is this the most journalism this moment that the show did?
Absolutely. Great framing.
There were other stories that were kind of larger than tennis stories that were addressed, right? For example, like this, the show starts Jabeur or Djokovic not being able to play the Australian Open, right? Where it's like, we're going to kind of go to it, but we're going to address it, not really dive in. And this was a dive in on a difficult topic.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say Nick, obviously facing the assault charges that he did, I thought they were able to do a little journalism in that because Nick was able to speak perhaps a little bit more freely than he was at the time with the press.
That really? I feel like my recollection is they just took a news clip that says he's been charged, and then that was it. That was the thing.
I guess it was the portrayal.
I don't think Nick said anything about it.
No, look, to go back to it, I agree with you. This was the most journalism done by the series. And again, Jabeur and what she meant to Tunisia, you got to just see it so tangibly. And so, again, it's another putting a picture or a photo to a concept you might have had in your head. Yes, this was the best journalism we saw.
It was also pretty easy to explain Sabalenka's tennis. I mean, double faults or something. Yeah, it was. I mean, you come on and it's like she
boom.
She hits the crap out of the ball. Yeah. And by the way, the auditory experience of Sabalenka also communicates that effectively. Mm-hmm. And then you have Paul Anacone come on and he's like, sometimes she goes off the rails and plays really, really badly, right? Yeah. And that was perfect. I'm not, that's not a direct quote, but it's basically, I was kind of waiting for the, when's the butt gonna come? And then they had Paul Anacone do the butt, and it was great. And also, double faults are really easy for everybody to understand. It was very simple. Whereas, like, I don't know.
Pace to the forehand when you jam her right hip, she misses that return. Sure, yeah, or like, really, or
like
that.
Hubert Hurkacz doesn't accelerate on his forehand. Like, they're not going to do that. But, like, double faults are very easy. So I think the whole tennis aspect of Sabalenka also worked really well.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. It is an auditory experience. That's the best way of putting it. You know, again, not just the sound of the ball coming off the racket, but the accompanying roar that she unleashes every time. You see the tiger tattoo. They double down on that. They portrayed, and again, hopefully there's Sabalenka involvement in season two or season three, whatever they're calling it, because, you know, she goes from that tour finals to winning freaking Australia. It's like, there is more meat on the bone here, and Sabalenka provides it on the court. She provides it off the court as well.
Yeah, I agree with you, but also just because she's good at this. Like, she was just very. She was just,
well, she
really,
like,
good.
Smiles at the camera. She poses as she's stretching with, like, the two fingers, and she doubles down. She embraces it. I think that's the best thing. Yeah. I do think what you come off with here, and I like to think we're both like this as well, so it resonates. Arina Sabalenka is unequivocally herself. Like, there's nothing fake. It's, look, I'm out there. I'm blasting away. I'm loud. I'm happy about it. This is who I am. Deal with it. And it's fascinating that those sorts of people can often rub others the wrong way. And Sabalenka is the best version of that, where it's like, no, but she's in on the joke too. Like, you have to understand, she completely understands it can go off the rails, and sometimes she struggles to deal with it.
The tennis aspect of this was basically, she kept losing to Iga all year, and Arena says this year, you know, Swiatek wins everything. It's really annoying. And then she exacts revenge on Swiatek before ultimately bowing out.
I love her quote. Well, I was gonna say, I like that she goes, look, I know I need to beat Iga. Like, that's who I have to beat. She did embrace that aspect of things, is like, and I love that she goes, and I think I can be good enough to do it. And it's just like, I love those little tidbits.
Yeah. There was some stuff in this that was very psychic of her. It's not psychic, right? I mean, everybody wants to win next year, but we'll get into those moments. Let's go to the
men. But she sells it. You're right. She actually sells it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. She believes it. And in that moment, she didn't necessarily have reason to believe it. Okay.
Yes.
Let's go to Taylor Fritz. This was an example, I think, of there wasn't much there. There wasn't much to run with. And you have to, like, here's the thing. You can't say that, okay, like, we're not going to do episode, we're going to ignore the men in episode 10 because nothing really compelling happened. But it felt like, it felt like a bit of a reach to me, the Fritz storyline. Not that it was a bad storyline, but I do think it pales in comparison to a lot of the other things we've seen gone down in the story. Let me just summarize before you get into it, and then you can agree with me or disagree with me.
Please.
A lot of it, the tennis aspect of it, is Taylor is tired of kind of people discrediting his win over Rafa because Rafa injured his rib, and he just wants to prove, and he got into the finals because Alcaraz got hurt. He just wants to prove here that win over Nadal at Indian Wells, which was featured in the doc, in the docuseries very prominently, that win was no coincidence, and he was going to back it up, and he does. So that's kind of, I mean, I guess there's more to the Taylor Turin story, but that's the main part of it. And I just think there are some aspects of that feel like a bit of a reach.
I don't know if they needed to show the men's finals. I get why they did. That's my source of disagreement, is you're right. It was a fun final note to wrap up the storyline, like, hey, it is a career season for Taylor Fritz. Let's keep that perspective in mind. This is what that career season looked like. I do think it was hilarious to watch how different it is. You know, again, those opening ceremonies for the guys and the women, the guys just are like, I'll throw on a suit, whatever. Like, yeah, I'll show up. Yeah, I'll brush the hair a little bit. And, you know, again, Taylor, the hair is always parted perfectly. The women doubled down and enjoyed it. You know, again, it's not often that they have that opportunity to dress up in front of one another and double down and embrace the photography of it all and, you know, glam it up. And it just looked like the women were having more fun. I don't know how, that would be my takeaway in what I saw in the dichotomy between the two. And maybe it's because the women's group is a little bit younger right now and they haven't all experienced it to the degree that the guys on the men's side have. You know, Rafa, Djokovic, what do they care about the ceremony? It's another suit in another city at another night. I liked that contrast. Like, maybe it was because it was in Fort Worth, the rodeo of it all, but that was the takeaway to me. Is like, it just looked like the women were having more fun.
Oh, wow. Okay. I guess I just muted myself by accident. I think the location actually had a lot to do with it, because first of all, the Fort Worth Stockyards are, it's a legendary experience that I have had the privilege of witnessing myself. The cows just walk across the market. It's incredible. And they opened with that. And that's kind of been a typical formula. Obviously, when the tour goes to another city, you introduce the city. You're like, this is where this is. Notice they said nothing about Turin. Yeah. And I literally wrote in my notes, I'm like, is there just nothing interesting,
dude,
about Turin?
The storyline of the show is Texas over Italy. Like, I agree. They didn't give us anything on Turin. That's a great call.
So I think that might have been part of it. And then I guess with Taylor, you get the Djokovic match where somebody in the crowd shouted and it made him miss the backhand. So that was also the big drama. But I was thinking with the Nadal win, I was like, do we want to, and look, this would, I'm not saying they should have said this, but I'm going to say that I was thinking it. It's like, yeah, Rafa just lost to Tommy Paul and he actually hasn't looked all that good since Wimbledon. So you can frame it as this big Taylor triumph, a big deal. Like, looking back, Ruski, do you consider that a big win for Fritz?
No, I didn't even remember it. I mean, I remembered him playing a good first match. I didn't remember who it was against prior to the episode. At the same time, totally. That's us. We're in the circle. We're in the loop. We're the people who are like, yeah, but you got to qualify that win because Rafa wasn't exactly healthy, and it was he. Like, the casual fan, it's still a win over Rafa. And I do think 30,000-foot view, 1,000-foot view, however many feet you'd like tonight here, Gil, that does matter. I do like, because it is it's the feather in the cap. It's just, look, Taylor Fritz had a real season. He didn't just beat Rafa once. He beat Rafa multiple times, and it doesn't matter the state of Rafa. You do that, you are one of the top eight guys in a year.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I also think the round-robin matches at those events don't feel as big just because you can lose.
Can we tennis tangent? This is my one tennis tangent, and then I'm shutting up and take us wherever you want to take us.
Go ahead.
The bonuses. They talk about the bonuses a little bit of the year-end finals at the beginning of this episode. And even for us in the circle, you're just like, wait, how much money for a match? Like, I'm sorry, what's at stake here? And like, they should just tweet that out every day. It's like, by the way, if you finish top eight, here's the bonus pool of the year-end finals. And then, you know, if there's any doubt that November tennis matters and that event matters, it's like, boy, check the bank account. It freaking matters.
Yeah. It's that tournament is a lot. It's a money-making machine.
Yeah,
for both tours. I mean, we've seen that. Hopefully we will see it again in a bigger way with the women, because they kind of ran into a speed bump. We won't get into that.
Well, snafu.
Yeah, a little bit. But yes, that is significant. I just, you know, for some of these guys, it matters more than others. On the Fritz topic, though, we do need to talk about the introduction of our man, Jordan, Fritz's son. I think when we talked about Fritz after episode 4, did you and I bring up the fact like, oh, are we not going to kind of delve in deep enough to talk about this? Do we mention that?
I think we did. I think I did. truth be told, because it's a that sounds like an Alex thing, not to address what I said, the third person, but when we do our pre-production meetings, that sounds like something I'd be like, should we talk about this? Yeah, like, it's just worth noting, with how modern science is, we don't talk, you know, people don't talk about this enough. Is Jordan to Taylor Bronny to LeBron? Like, are they going to play some doubles together? Because age-wise, it really could happen. And boy, would that be cool if it does.
True. There's that awesome scene in the car.
Yeah.
Where Jordan knows the capital of Georgia, the country. Which is awesome.
Do you think Taylor knows the capital of Georgia, the state?
No, I don't. I don't think Taylor thinks. I think Taylor wouldn't even.
I really hope like that was the geography lesson that day, and Jordan was in class, and he's like, God, I'm going to get my dad so badly with this. No. Like, I'm going to crush him.
I don't think that's it. Like, I just think he's a genius. I think Fritz's son is a genius.
No, I mean, it checks out. It was a great video. It was delightful.
So, you know, look. Was that a storyline that needed 20 minutes and that we need it completely changed everything? No, but I think it just adds layers to Taylor Fritz, the person. And 100%. I'm just really glad we kind of saw that part of him introduced. Yeah. And maybe it goes back to, remember Carrie said, like, some guys just got more comfortable with us as we went through the year. And this might have been the fruits of that.
100%. It just is, again, what the purpose of including Fritz in this episode was, there were some things to address. And I think they did a great job of you're right. You got the complete look at Fritz the person now as well, beyond just Fritz the player and Fritz the adversity of hurting his, you know, foot and his ankle at Indian Wells. Now you got to see just all aspects of Taylor Fritz, what 2022 was like for him. And it did a great job. You know, it was a personal documentary for him. Not too shabby.
Yeah, absolutely. This episode ends with a nice montage of many of the players we have come to enjoy and get connected to over the course of these 10 episodes. It goes to Nick, though, and Nick goes, who knows? I'll just put a massive question mark on 2023.
Yeah, it was. That's a good one-liner. Like, they,
today,
you know, when they, yeah.
Today was, he withdrew from the U.S. Open. By the way,
yeah, he's played what, like two matches, one match. Yeah, that's
Wu Yibing.
Big question mark. Again, it's pure Nick. It was a, you know, the moment they got that, they're like, cut it. They're like, that's the final clip. We found it.
No,
I like the final montage.
That's the final Nick clip.
That's what I meant. Is that's like, that's our last look at Nick. Is that's where we got to end it with him.
Let's go to the final clip, I believe. At least it's my last bullet point in my notes. So that could that could be misleading. But Sabalenka goes, next season, it's my year, guys.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been funny if you have Fritz going, you know, I think I'm going to finish 11th. Like, you know, I thought I exceeded a little too fast. Yeah, it was wonderful. Maybe this is where I'll offer my final thoughts. As a tennis player, you have to be a little bit crazy because it's just you out there. And yes, they've introduced coaching, but ultimately you're the one making every choice. You're the one who's got to slug it out, often two and a half hours, blistering sun, rain, bearing down on you. And every so often, it just drives you nuts. Every so often, you're going to have the day, the serve's not clicking. I just can't land the forehand on the run cross court. The game's just not where I'm going to needs to be. And once every 1,000 times out there, you will just go fucking nuts. And for Aryna Sabalenka to be out there and say, now everyone sees me fucking losing it. Like, been there. Like, everyone has their story of that one time they lost it. They lost the thread. And through all of that, you just got to persist. You just got to stay the course. And you still have to have an irrational self-belief that, okay, it didn't work today, but next season's my year. Or next time's my year. And, like, again, Sabalenka put that final bow on it beautifully, that you get the full spectrum of, yeah, I know I went crazy. I know these were my first 4 months. I know I'm dealing with all this stuff, but next year's my year. And it's just like, it's remarkable. That's a tennis player in a nutshell.
I felt like I was at a TED talk just now. That was like Gruskin teaches the psychology of tennis.
You had that one moment. When was your blow up? I could tell you exactly when and where mine was.
I mean, I'll tell you this. Some guy I was in warmups was like hitting winners, passing shots, like just wouldn't really let me warm up at all. And I was pretty young. I got unbelievably rattled and then got completely crushed. And the kid started yelling, come on, like after the second point, and it persisted. Like I just really hated this guy to the point where like I couldn't play. And I just cried a lot after the match. Mm-hmm. And then, but it was a great teaching moment. And this is why everybody needs to play tennis. The kids out there need to play tennis. Because I promised to myself that I would never let somebody get in my head like that again. And I don't think I have.
100%. Junior year, Club Tennis Nationals, round of 16. Florida robbed us of a victory because we fucking handed it to them. I was so mad. Like, I think that was the last time I had like a full on tear fest, like where I lost control. Like I was so mad, so many F-bombs. And I look at Rothman and I was like, this is never happening again. And we won it the next year. Hit the YouTube, baby. Club Tennis National Championships 2017 tells the story.
Well, I was 12. You were 20. So that really represents
I was 20. Like let the record show. I was a full on 20.
That's all people need to know about our development track. this show's gone off the rails. We are going to do an episode, obviously, before season two comes out, where we'll give our large scale, big picture thoughts. I'm sure, you know, we like rankings. I'm sure we'll rank the episodes and do all that fun stuff. But I think for this one, we have said enough. This has been awesome. Thank you to Kerry, Leah for coming on, of course, and hope everybody enjoyed this one. So for Alex Gruskin, I am Gil Gross. This has been The Breakpoint Show on the Cracked Rackets Network of Podcasts and the Gil Gross YouTube channel.